Access number 28678, Mr. Dermot Rhodes, Reel 8. Now, what's the next phase? We've talked about the technical scientific courses. We talked about the drill parades. And what else were you doing while you were at...
That was for the first 3 months. And then for the last 6 months, we tend to do a lot more travelling and advanced gunnery and familiarisation with other services. We spent 6 weeks at the Naval Air Station in Lossiemouth doing air weaponry, because then the gunnery branch was responsible for all the air weapons, rockets, cannons, shells, and lot. And we actually flew at Lossie and we dropped bombs. We flew, of course, with the pilot in mainly sea vampires. And we dropped bombs and we fired cannons and fired rockets on the range up there. We had a tremendous social life with the fleet harem, as one always does. We spent some weeks with the Royal Artillery on Salisbury Plain.
What were you learning from them?
We were learning then from them the value of naval gunfire support, what we could do for the enemy. We also learned from them what sort of weapons they had and how they operated. And that was always a good, a very good exchange. A number of the people I met at that initial time, I met subsequently throughout my time in the service, who worked with us. That was the Royal Artillery. We drove tanks. We went to the tank place at Bovington, drove tanks, and all sorts of army vehicles to get some sort of flavour for what they did. We also did a number of sea firings. We actually went to sea and fired our own guns at various targets, sleep targets, and we were examined in all this.
Now, what were the range of naval weapons at the time? If you, I don't know whether you can go through any of them, but...
I can go to... Well, the biggest gun at sea then was the 6-inch, which was mainly in... Well, it was only in cruisers then. Down from that was the 4.5-inch. Now, the 4.5-inch was the main medium-range anti-aircraft, dual-purpose and surface-to-surface weapon, the gun. It was fitted in those days in some of the aircraft carriers, but certainly throughout the fleet in destroyers and frigates, and is to this day. It is regarded by the Army as the smallest naval weapon that's any use to them in support of their operations ashore for naval gunfire support. And now it's a dual purpose, again, anti-air, anti-surface. You can also fire illuminants with it out to a range of about 9 or 10 miles. Quick loading. Also in those days we had the 4-inch, which was either a twin or a single mounting, which was rather less sophisticated, radar controlled, again like the 4.5-inch, anti-aircraft or anti-surface with a reduced range compared with the 4.5-inch, fitted in some frigates. Down from that, a strange hybrid, a couple of the cruisers, the Tiger and the Blake, had some quick-firing 3-inch guns, which were anti-aircraft. They were twin mountings, and only in those ships, and I never actually served with any of them. But then one type of weapon that was prevalent throughout the fleet was the Bofors, 40mm. Either fitted in a single or even quadruple mountings in the earlier days, but normally twin or single, locally aimed and fired, visual tracking and visual aiming. Fairly limited range of about, against aircraft, of about 2,000 yards, if that. Below that was a 20mm Oerlikon rapid fire out to about 1,000 yards. A lot of noise, very effective, very impressive. And then there's a range of small arms as well that ships carried, Bren guns, the 7.62 rifle, the 303 rifle earlier than that, 9mm pistol. We also carried submachine guns as well in ships to equip landing parties or sentries and so on and so forth.
So you had to know all these?
Yep.
And you did, we went out to sea firing.
And you looked after them, and you had to carry the ammunition and look after that.
And you went out sea firing, testing most of that, presumably.
We went, during the long course, we actually had to go out and take charge of the operation of these weapons and, in fact, direct them in a shoot.
So that's good. What about missiles?
We did. We actually, during this course, we went around a number of factories. To Vickers, Hawkesy, Liz, Armstrong, Whitworth, to see missiles or parts of missiles being made. And we actually came up here to Coventry where they made bits, pieces of them. So we learnt a bit about the operation and principles of these. Not quite so much about the mechanics of using ships, because we didn't have, certainly not in my day, as much of a simulation and training aids as they do now. But we learnt what they were capable of, certainly. So that was our long course.
But you didn't do firing?
We didn't fire any missiles.
Are they just too expensive, I presume?
Well, they were too expensive, and of course they were very much intended, any firings, for the training of the ship's crews, not you.
Now, so anything else about the long course? How was it assessed? I mean, did you all pass, or...?
We had a great series of examinations, about 10 or 15 various subjects at the end, towards the end of the course. Some of the assessments were made actually on the spot for our practical firings and things like that. And we all passed, I think. Yes, we did. Yeah, because we had training with us. We had Canadians, Australians, Pakistanis, Indians, and the South African.
Now, this course, the whole course took what, a year?
It was a year. Yeah,
62 to 63.
Yes. Yeah.
So what next?
So now I was sent to sea as a gunnery officer. And I was, in 1964, went to HMS Devonshire as the second gunnery officer. Now, HMS Devonshire was a county-class guided missile destroyer. Main armament was Sea Slug missile, twin Sea Slug launcher, and then fired two twin 4.5-inch guns and 40mm as well.
Now, what did you think of the Sea Slug? I mean, that's what you've been... you've been doing the trials for it. Was it one of the first ships in that actually had them fitted?
Yeah, Devonshire, funnily enough, was the first guided missile destroyer, operational guided missile destroyer. I joined her in the second commission, in other words, about 18 months after she'd first commissioned. Having
was
done
the guided
trials.
Missile very much the main armament? Of the ship, or was it a second?
It was the main armament, longest range, and hopefully the most effective. It was also, Devonshire had a Wessex Mark III helicopter fitted in the anti-submarine role with a dunking sonar, so that was quite a potent weapon against submarines, one hoped.
Now, what was your duties?
So they're big ships, 5,000 tons.
And what was your duty as a secondary gunnery officer?
Well, second, I was the assistant to the first gunnery officer, who was a lieutenant commander. I was still a lieutenant and assisted him, whatever. I was given as my special responsibility, the 4.5-inch, two twin turrets to look after and to train up.
Now, tell us a bit about the 4.5-inch turrets, then. I mean... you've mentioned them in outline, but what were your duties, your responsibility for them?
Well, mine was to train up the whole crew. Now, the whole crew of that consisted of personnel on the gun direction platform, which is above the bridge, right, and up the open air. The actual turret crews, and they were about... I suppose six in each turret, but also the magazine crews right down below that, providing the the ammunition, the shells and the cartridges, up from the magazines. And so there are about 15 altogether in each of those crews, together with the transmitting station crews, because these were the people down below who actually acquired the target on radar, locked on and followed it, and in fact, the gun was fired from there as well. There were two people in there, each side, so that's four. Then there was the director, aimer, and layer. This is the guy sitting up in the gun director, which is like a little steel cabin up way up on the top of the ship, which is the row of the radar area, fire control radar, was situated. And he would provide any visual elements into this, whether it's for surface firing or even aircraft, he could track visually. So, and there were two people in there. The guy who was controlling it all was either on the gun direction platform or, more likely, which is where I was in the operations room. And I was the gun director blind, and the blind was because you couldn't actually see visually anything. It was all done by radar. And you were then next door to and working with the command, but also the torpedo officer, the navigating officer, the aircraft controller, all in the same operations room.
Now, take me through your role as gun director blind in the operations room, because that sounds complex and we haven't covered that yet.
Well, the gun director blind in the ops room was responsible for the deployment and use of all the armaments in the ship in the radar mode, if you like. He would work very closely with the target detection radar people and the aircraft controllers. They would detect on long, hopefully on long range radar, a target coming in. They would identify it or not, as the case may be, and then they would allocate it if it was far enough away as a target for the gun director. If something popped up at short range, the gun director didn't wait to be allocated targets. He would take it on his own authority and decide to engage. You don't have time to start asking questions. If something pops up, you assume that it's hostile and have a go at it, which makes it absolutely vital you know where your own aircraft are and your own ships. You're sitting then in front of a large screen, and you detect this target, or it's passed on from somebody else, and you then put an electronic marker on that, which would send details of the targets, range and bearing, down to the gun system. And the gun system would operate its fire control radar or missile system, physically lock on to the target. You would then control that engagement and give them the permissive order to fire at a certain range, normally beyond the maximum effective range of the weapon, so that as it came in, when it reached the maximum effective range, which for a 4.5-inch gun system was 6,000 yards, bang, he would press the trigger and off the gun would go and shoot, and hopefully you'd knock it down. In the meantime, once you're having done, you'd forget about that and start looking for other targets as well. Well, you'd be done doing that anyway, because you had a little team with you of two or three people, radar operators, who'd be looking for that. At the same time, you would probably be talking to other ships in the group. You'd be talking to their gun directors, telling them which targets you were taking, or receiving information from them, which targets were coming in. And so you exchange, you kept up what was called an air picture, or even a surface picture as well, so you knew exactly what was in your area and what it was doing.
Now, what did you think of the Devonshire? What was your
accommodation? Great ship, lovely.
We haven't done accommodation for a while. I mean, you're now a lieutenant. What does a lieutenant get on a ship like that? What's your...
He gets a cabin 6x6.
And what's in there?
There's a bunk on top of a desk unit. and a wash basin and a small wardrobe, and that's it. And hardly enough room to swing a cat. This is at 6x6. It's a sort of standard size, and I mean, that's a standard size for, well, not now, but certainly then.
Did most you mind the size? I mean,
no, no, it was great. I mean, bearing in mind some of the accommodation I had before, this was luxury. It was a new ship. I thought this was great stuff.
Now, what about the wardroom? What was can you talk about the officer's wardroom and what it was like to be a member of it?
Yeah, well, first of all, in Devonshire, we had about 40 officers. Bearing in mind, we had quite a considerable spread of equipment, electronic equipment, weapons. We had a helicopter, so we had a full pilot and observer for that. So we had must have been nearly 40 officers. The wardroom was quite spacious in many respects and a very pleasant place to be. It was invariably on the upper deck with sort of ports, scuttles you could see out of. And our social life was conducted from there. You met in the wardroom certainly every lunchtime to have a drink before lunch. Not at sea, we never drank at sea, but certainly in harbour. And this was the one occasion where you could meet people you might not. I mean, people could bury themselves away in the bowels of a ship for weeks on end. You might never see them unless they came to the wardroom. You do that, your social activities were there, your parties were there, your dinners, your meals were there. And you had a staff of stewards and cooks to look after you.
Did you not drink at all at sea, or just not at lunch time?
No. I didn't, as it was just a tradition, and one never did. The watchkeepers, the drivers, if you like, the watchkeepers and the seaman officers never ever drank at sea. Occasionally, you used to find, not many engineers did, the supply and secretariat officers occasionally might have a glass of wine, but nothing more than that. It was a virtual embargo on drinking at sea. It was all soft drinks.
Now, how much drinking in harbour? Was it serious drinking or...?
Independent on the occasion. You probably have a social drink at lunchtime. Certainly no, not normally more than two unless you'd invite another ship over for drinks. And in the evening, you might have a drink before you go ashore. You might have a drink when you come back. If you stayed on board for dinner, you might have it's normally sharing a bottle of wine with several other people in harbour.
So not excessive drink?
No. I mean, you had parties when sometimes you had a fair old time. But most of the excessive drinking, if at all, was done ashore.
I'll come back. Cause now, where had you joined? I should have asked that. Where did you join the Devonshire?
I joined the Devonshire in Portsmouth.
Now, where were you to go? Which fleet was she going to belong to?
Well, she was. Devonshire was almost brand new. There weren't many of them around, and she was a bit of a show ship. And therefore, we were not allocated specifically to any. Fleet for any great length of time. Whilst I was on board the Devonshire, mainly under the command of Captain David Williams, later Admiral Sir David Williams, another second Sea Lord, great man, lovely, lovely man.
Well, let's talk. This, as you brought him up, what was he like? Why did you hadn't liked the other one so much? But what was to
Andrew Lewis? No, he was a miserable old sir. David Williams was a most approachable captain. He was a great man with a great lantern jaw, very imposing, but with a tremendous twinkle in his eye and a wonderful sense of humour, and quite gentle in his normal sort of talk. Mind you, he was another gunnery specialist, and when he wanted, he could certainly put you in your place. But he was a very easy man to get on with, and as long as you did your job and you did it efficiently, you provided the goods, he was terrific, all sweetness and light, and I got on very well with him, I thought a lot of him, and I was delighted to see, to my mind, one of the best second sea lords we've ever had. So he was our captain.
So where were you going?
I'll tell you where we went, and I could tell you which is where we didn't go. we went to Gibraltar, we went to Malta, we went, then we did a trip out to the Far East, we went to...
What were you doing in the Mediterranean?
We were doing basically more trials, firing trials. But with an operational system this time.
Now, what about those firing trials? You wouldn't be particularly involved. You were more on the other side of gunnery. But
I was involved as assistant gunnery officer. I used to act as a safety number, or I just used to have a specific job to keep an eye on certain aspects of what was going on.
Now, how was the operational system of CSTO going compared to the test system?
Well, it was still in sort of fairly early days, and so we still had a number of aspects of the missile envelope to probe. A missile has a certain envelope, and the missile envelope is the area around the launch platform in which the missile is still guidable and is effective as a weapon. Outside that envelope, it runs out of puff or whatever and starts coming down, or it's out beyond range of guiding. And so we were still probing the extent of that to some degree. Otherwise, it was mainly practice firings in an operational role. And we also did some firings of the SeaCat missile, which was a short-range missile.
Now, tell me a bit, we haven't mentioned that. What about the SeaCat?
Well, the SeaCat missile was a short-range anti-aircraft missile, wire-guided, which meant that you had a SeaCat aimer who sat on beside the launcher, fired his missile, and actually, with a thumb joystick, manually guided it onto the target. All he had to do, in fact, was the target would be tracked in either by radar or, again, visually. And the missile going out had a flare at the back end, and he'd keep the missile flare superimposed on the target. Eventually, hopefully, the two would coincide. But it was fairly short range, about a couple of miles.
And was this a new thing as well, or was this an old...
It was fairly new. No, it was fairly new. It was it's almost a contemporary with the Sea Slug, but a little bit later.
Now, you're doing firing trials in the Mediterranean.
So we did some firing.
Anything else in the Mediterranean?
Not very much, because we then went out to the West Indies.
And what were you doing out there?
Almost, again, as a flag-showing type of visit. We visited some of the West Indian, the Caribbean islands, Grenada, St. Vincent, Jamaica. I think that was probably...
And what were they showing the flag
about it? It was what the Navy has always done for a couple of hundreds of years, showing a presence, really, supporting our bases. We still had a major dockyard in Bermuda, our bases out there, and providing some sort of security for the islanders. There was always a bit of sort of piracy, and drugs were starting to be an issue there. So that's the sort of thing we did there, but it was lowish key. We did make contact with the Americans, but not beyond the odd exercise with them. We then came back and started on our major cruise, where we went to... We went south about around the Cape. To Australia, Singapore, Malaysia.
Now, what do you remember of this trip?
And Japan.
Sounds a major undertaking.
It was.
On your own?
Sorry?
Did you go on your own?
Oh, yes, yeah, mainly on our own, yeah, single cruise. And we went, it was almost another flag-saying social cruise. At the time, there was quite a lot of activity in Malaysia. It was Malaysian confrontation time. And I think they were slightly concerned about having this brand new all singing, all dancing ship too close to any trouble. We did actually do a couple of patrols, and we did actually visit Borneo. But then we went off, and we were based for a short time in Singapore. Then we went off on a wonderful trip to Australia, where we spent, we started off in New South Wales to Sydney, where it happened the MCC were playing. And we had a cocktail party, which we invited the MCC team. Most of them came, except Geoffrey Boycott. And we had a great night, and we finished. I remember, I don't know, I can say it, I suppose I can, actually. The bowlers appeared to be the more sociable, and we had a great time with Freddie Underwood and Derek Underwood and Freddie Titmuss. And Freddie Titmuss was carried off the ship in some early hours. And with the others who were in not much better shape. And they were one day into a match against New South Wales. And I thought, they're never going to get on the ground the next morning, never mind anything else. But oh me, they were there. And Freddie Titmuss, who'd been carried off the ship 3 hours beforehand, took 3 wickets before lunch that morning. Wonderful.
That's Sydney.
This is in Sydney, yeah. Not a test match, I have to say. It's New South Wales, they were playing. Then we went to Melbourne, and of course in Melbourne they looked down on people from Sydney. And our, I think it was slightly more or less rowdy was our entertainment in Melbourne, but it was great. Everybody was extremely kind to us. And then we spent Christmas in Fremantle, which is Perth, really, with the beach on one side and the jetty on the other. So we spent Christmas on the beach. But we had a wonderful time there. We organised. We got a very good... Another lieutenant compatriot of mine was a National Service who converted to regular and was a graduate of the Royal College of Music. And he formed a ship's choir, and we sang on television. And then we got carried away and went carol singing around the streets of Perth on Christmas Eve, only to find out that it was illegal. Just as the police were about to cart us off. In fact, they took us back to the ship and said, hey, boys, you can't do this in Australia. So that was Perth and Fremantle. And in those days, Australia was a favourite place for deserters to jump ship there, because they'd met some girl who couldn't do without them, or it was the wide open spaces, and it was a great country. And of course, we told our sailors, look, you may be tempted, but we'll tell you, you will be turned in either by a jealous boyfriend, or a girl who's had enough of you, or you will be exploited by, if you last long enough, by an employer, who pays you a pittance way below the legal the wage for doing a menial task. So bear that in mind before you think of going on the trot, as the phrase was in there. However, when we left, and there's quite a long sort of breakwater coming out of Fremantle, which is our last port in Australia, we could see as we left, and we'd left about three or four behind who'd disappeared, we could see three of these sailors on the edge of the breakwater waving to us. What they didn't know is we'd left a boat behind for this eventuality. We'd heard of this. So while they were busy waving, there was a boat approaching from the other side to pick them up and bring them back on board.
How were they treated? I mean, that's a pretty serious offence, but not at war, I suppose.
Oh, yes. I mean, it is. It's quite difficult to... desertion is what it is, basically. And very, very serious penalties. Not quite death then, but a long time in prison. And we always had a rule, people who deserted, to repatriate them and go back to the ship, they had to pay their own airfares or travel fares. Well, we'd save these guys the travel fare by picking them up and getting them back on board. And then... it was a question of proving desertion and the intention had to be proved to remain permanently absent from the ship. Well, it wasn't always easy. Most of these cases were downgraded to a long, prolonged and aggravated, as you used to call them, periods of absence. They were fined quite a lot of money and didn't go ashore for a long time after that, but they didn't get sent back to Colchester for 2 years in prison, which they could well have done.